dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who knows his way around a good intelligence briefing, of course, is the president of the Center for Security Policy, a career intelligence professional by training. He is Fred Flights. He is, among other things, a man who has served in the intelligence community as an analyst at the CIA and DIA. He has served as an overseer of the intelligence community, as a professional staff member on the House Intelligence Committee, and he has been the chief of staff to Ambassador John Bolton, both as an undersecretary in the Department of State and as the national security advisor to President Donald Trump. He's always welcome here. Fred Flights, good to have you back.
Hey, Frank, good to be here.
Well, I caught you last night on Shannon Bream talking about Iran and what is going on at the moment with this so-called Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. The Iranians have now acknowledged that they are violating the terms of that agreement. The IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, has confirmed that they are doing it. The Europeans are in a swivet about it. Tell us what you make of what's happening at the moment. And more to the point, Fred, am I right that the Iranians have actually been violating this treaty or agreement, not even a treaty, really from the get-go?
Well, those are all great questions. And this is exactly right, that the Iranians have been violating this agreement from the beginning. To get the $150 billion in sanctions relief in early 2016, Iran was supposed to provide a full and thorough accounting of its nuclear program, and we knew in December 2015 that it gave an answer to the IAEA that was incomplete and false. And last year, the Israelis acquired a huge archive of nuclear documents from Iran that indicated it planned to build 5 nuclear weapons, conduct underground nuclear tests, acquire nuclear fuel from abroad. You know, so they've been cheating from the beginning. They've also never allowed inspections of military sites. And I know the conventional wisdom is that Iran has been complying and our intelligence community has said that. Why they said that is another story. It just isn't true. What we're seeing now is that Iran is violating limits on the enrichment of reactor-grade uranium. They're limited to 300 kilograms as a stockpile. They're not supposed to enrich more than 3.67% uranium-235. That's the form of uranium you can use for nuclear power or for nuclear bombs. And I mean, it's a troubling development, but it doesn't appreciably move Iran closer towards a nuclear weapon. It sets a precedent for that. The danger is that the Obama administration let Iran continue to enrich uranium while the JCPOA was in effect, which lets Iran continue to perfect its capability to make nuclear weapons fuel. And it gave it a tool, a weapon it could use to blackmail the international community if it was ever dissatisfied with the nuclear deal. Whenever it was dissatisfied, it could simply ramp up its enrichment. It shouldn't be enriching. That has to be the key to a new nuclear deal.
Well, I want to come back to that. But first of all, let's focus on the blackmailing, because that certainly seems to be what's afoot at the moment. They're saying to the Europeans, in as many words, we're going to do even more violations of this agreement if you don't meet our demands over the next 60 days. What are you hearing from European capitals, Fred? You talked on Fox News last night about the effect of this behavior on the Iranians' part, driving the Europeans into Donald Trump's arms rather than having the opposite effect. What's the evidence one way or the other?
That's right. Who would have predicted this? The Iranians seem to think that by breaking their agreements on uranium enrichment and by engaging in what is basically acts of terror by mining ships in the Persian Gulf, shooting down this unarmed drone, planning to attack U.S. forces with terrorist groups, that they can force the United States and Europe to change their policies. But what's happening is Europe is actually not giving in to this Iranian blackmail. They've been lecturing the Iranians on this behavior, demanding that they stop. There's been some protests in Europe over Iran's behavior. And Iran seems to think that it's going to ratchet up its violations of the nuclear deal again, and that'll put more pressure on Europe. I think they're actually driving European leaders closer to President Trump. Not that European leaders are happy about this, but their patience with Iran is running out.
Well, it should be out, as far as I'm concerned. I can't imagine why this is still going on, but at the very least, they had best be alive to the reality that Iran is on the march to having the means to threaten them as well as us. I did want to ask you about one thing. Your former boss, John Bolton, said very directly yesterday at the Christians United for Israel conference that we're not going to be negotiating with a regime that is endlessly chanting death to America. That's music to my ears, because it seems to me that there's no good that can come from further negotiations with these guys. And yet there's some talk that that may be the desired next step. Can you help us understand where we actually are on the question of negotiating with this regime?
President Trump has expressed his willingness to negotiate with both North Korea and Iran. He said he will talk to the Iranians without preconditions. Now, when we heard talks like this from the Obama administration, you know, there were lots of concessions that they were planning on making. If there ever are talks between the United States and Iran, I think that we're going to have a very tough bottom line, and the Iranians know that. Now, whether we will be able to use President Trump's maximum pressure strategy to force the Iranians to the negotiating table, I think the chances of that are very unlikely right now. I think the best we can do is to put on tough sanctions that denies Iran access to technology to make missiles and nuclear power and revenue it would use to fund terrorist groups and its other belligerent activities. So I don't think talks are in the offing, but President Trump is willing to talk if the Iranians are willing to come to the table.
Yeah. Let me turn to the question of those sanctions and maximum pressure. There's evidence that the Chinese are continuing to buy Iranian fuel, that they're doing so somewhat surreptitiously. They're turning off the tracking devices for ships going into Iran, for example, as they're making port. What is the likelihood, Fred Flights, that we're going to see the Trump administration essentially allowing that to happen, giving formally a waiver to the Chinese to continue doing what they seemingly are going to do with or without permission?
Well, I know when these sanctions were put in place, there was an assumption that there would be cheating like this. The sanctions are doing an enormous amount of damage to the Iranian economy. But there's a number of nations that are either going to overtly or covertly cheat. And we simply have to get after these nations and let them know that this is unacceptable and that there will be a strong economic cost if they don't buckle under. So if this is going on, I imagine there's pretty tough talks right now between Washington and Beijing.
Fred Flights, we have to leave it at that. I thank you, as always, for your leadership at the Center for Security Policy, your terrific and ongoing public service, now out of government, and for the chance to have you on the program from time to time. You speak knowledgeably about what's going on, and I'm very grateful to for your insights, as always. Come back to us again next week. Next up, we'll speak with Daniel Horowitz about citizenship and the census. That and more, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It is with the greatest of pleasure that I say welcome to our next guest. He is Daniel Horowitz, one of the smartest guys I know, a senior editor at Conservative Review, where he authors its Conservative Consciousness with Daniel Horowitz. He has been featured in any number of other places, but I am particularly appreciative of one of his major works. It's called Stolen Sovereignty: How to Stop Unelected Judges from Transforming America. And there is a case in point we're going to come to in a moment in connection with the Democrats' determined effort to open our borders to all comers. But before we get to that, I did want to pick Daniel's brain about another topic that he's also been writing about lately, involving this question of whether to ask in the census next year whether the respondents are citizens of the United States. Daniel Horowitz, welcome back. It's so good to have you. And what's the answer to that question?
Well, it's definitely great to be with you. And yeah, I mean, we've reached the point in our country where we are even asking this question. Are we allowed to have a nation? Are we allowed to have a sovereign nation? Do we have the right to even know who is a citizen, much less count citizens for the most foundational purpose, constitutional purpose of reapportionment, taking a census? I mean, this thing has gone 100 yards down the field beyond where it should have been stuffed at the line of scrimmage. This should have never been a legitimate case in the courts. The president should have asserted executive authority over this a long time ago. But, you know, we allow them to litigate this stuff and we make it legitimate. The bottom line is taking a census is executive authority. It's not an individualized interaction between a citizen and its government. It's a fundamental abstract political question that courts have no jurisdiction over. I mean, it's just that simple. You know, five justices, including Chief Justice Roberts, admitted that this is the foundational purpose of a census, that it was there since our founding. They admit that the Constitution authorizes it. They admit that statute authorizes it. They admit that even the Administrative Procedure Act was followed in properly making this regulation. And then Roberts just made a U-turn and said, well, I don't know. I just don't think you're telling me all the reasons. So what? I mean, that's the thing. If the court said he has the authority, which we don't need the court to tell us that anyway, he has the authority. We have three branches of government. It's time they push back.
And that seems to be what President Trump is doing, though it's not exactly clear how he's going to do it. What are you hearing, Daniel Horowitz, about this determination on his part, and evidently now, belatedly, it seems William Barr, the Attorney General, to find a way to meet this diktat from John Roberts and get the question posed, despite the fact that some millions of forms have now been printed that don't have that included in them?
Well, I think for one, it shows politically the importance of conservatives speaking out. You know, often the administration will do something liberal, and what I call the conservative Teletubbies and conservative media will just start dancing around and praising it or defending it when they don't realize, really, you need to take a sledgehammer to them. Often the president doesn't realize it or he's getting bad advice. And this is what happened. Initially, the Commerce Department was just going to throw in the towel and not even go back to the district court, as Robert said, but just totally give up. And that was ridiculous. So thankfully enough, conservatives got in the president's face and he decided to make a change. But again, if we don't hold him to it, I'm not convinced that we're going to necessarily get a good outcome here. But again, it's important to realize that my view personally, and I believe this is the constitutional view, is that the courts do not have the sole and final arbiter status over constitutional interpretation. But this case is even better because they agreed with the president on the constitutional interpretation. So, I mean, there's really nothing to run away from here. He needs to go ahead and write it on the census. Courts do not have the ability to stop him from doing that. The only thing a court can do is, let's say a private citizen doesn't want to answer the question, and federal government comes in to fine the person, well, then, you know, any criminal conviction or fine being levied, yeah, he could go to court and deal with it there. But in terms of actually preventing him from ripping it out of the census, that is executive authority. That's just not the judicial power.
Yeah, this is such an important point. And again, it's born of, I know, your deep study of what the courts are doing to overreach. And I do want to talk about that in the open borders context. But just really quickly, Daniel Horowitz, could you just give us in the most succinct form possible, what are the stakes if we are unable to determine who is a citizen in this census of 2020?
Well, first off, there's just the global horizontal consequences of judicial supremacy that this will once again telegraph the message that any district judge, in this case, a random dude in Maryland, could determine any national question and the administration will give up. And that has bearings on many, many issues with immigration and life and election law. But I mean, I think in terms of this, people don't realize that illegal aliens are voting even without voting. Now, many of them are voting, but even without voting, they get a vote. And here's how they get a vote. By us refusing to determine who is properly here and just indiscriminately counting any organism within the country, what happens is you get a distorted reapportionment where California gets 4 to 5 extra seats. That's a big deal. I mean, Frank, that was the margin of Obamacare passing the House by about a 5-seat margin. Remember, it's also affects the presidential elections because they get 4 or 5 extra electoral votes. And, you know, in a very closely divided country, often that can make all the difference.
Mm-hmm. So a lot riding on this. I hope that conservatives will stay on the case, as it were, and that the president will actually see this through to completion. And I appreciate so much your good works on this front. Let me turn to one of the other subjects that you're also working tirelessly on. And another of these federal judges, a Marsha Peckman, I believe it is, in Washington State, has done a similar thing to what you were just describing, established by fiat, what her new law will be with respect to important immigration issues. Talk us through what's going on that front, Daniel, and again, the implications for our sovereignty as well as our security.
Sure. So last week, this Seattle judge, Marsha Peckman, essentially expanded the catch and release edict of a previous judge that he applied to family units, someone who comes with a child, just applied it to pretty much everyone, even single adults. People forget, and I want to make this very clear for your listeners. The law doesn't say that if you come here with a kid, you have to be released within 20 days. Okay. Section 235B1, B2 of the INA, which passed the Senate unanimously in 1996, says that anyone that has seeking asylum shall be detained. There's no exceptions. There's no time limits. That is the law. It was designed to prevent this very outcome. So the law says the opposite. It's this Judge Sabraw a year ago said, oh, well, you know, for kids, I don't know, you got to release them. Just made that up. So, and therefore you have to release the parent with them. Just completely made it up. Now in comes this Seattle judge and says, for everyone, you have to release them. She said that law is unconstitutional. I don't like that law. You can't do that. They have to get a bond hearing within, 7 days, she said, of coming here. Now, if you notice, Seattle is not at the border.
Southern border.
Yeah. And evidently, again, how they can just go to one judge and they can nullify what Congress passes unanimously. But again, the answer is they can't. They have no such power. They don't nullify. There is no power of the veto that was given to the judiciary. There's no jurisdiction over immigration, over people coming in to the border right now. It's as if they're not here, if they're not given legal status. As I note in my article, there's 130 years of case law on this. At some point, we got to say no. They are engaging in civil disobedience. And one final point, Frank, even some of our allies are saying, well, Congress needs to act. I challenge them to answer this question. What do you want Congress to do? Well, pass new laws. What laws? The courts are saying the old laws can't be implemented. So the point is, we don't have an immigration law problem. We have a judicial tyranny and judicial supremacy problem. And that's where we need to put our efforts into fighting this, pushing back against the notion of judicial supremacy. Because once you agree and accede to the notion that a single judge could nullify immigration law, there is not a single thing you could pass in Congress today that's going to change this game.
Yeah, the so-called comprehensive immigration reform is a complete, you know, non-starter. Even if it were a good idea, it would be completely irrelevant as long as you say, a single judge is going to steal our sovereignty. Just very quickly, Daniel Horowitz, what's on the line if we no longer have borders, if we no longer have enforceable laws either there or in the interior of the United States with respect to people coming here unlawfully?
Well, you know, if you have a family and, you know, you're in a nicer part of the country and you have a seamless conduit from a really bad area of town and there's signs up to come into your house, well, what's your house going to look like? Basically, our border and the Mexican cartels that do the trafficking serve as a pipeline, a conduit for every ill in the world that we served as a beacon, a refuge from. We are now getting them in our country.
Daniel Horowitz, thank you. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. Next up, Colonel Dr. Lawrence Sellin joins us straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. I'm very pleased to say, joined by Colonel Dr. Lawrence Sellin, a man of considerable accomplishment, both in uniform as a colonel in the United States Army Reserves, with combat experience in Afghanistan and Iraq, with business experience at senior levels, executive at places like IBM, and in the physiology business, the pathology division of the U.S. Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases, among other accomplishments. I'm always appreciative of his time. Dr. Lawrence Sellin, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's so good to have you.
Oh, thank you, Frank.
You have been, of course, keeping a keen eye on what is going on in Central and South Asia, specifically with respect to Afghanistan. And I wanted to get your read on the latest, particularly through the prism of what we're now being told is an imminent deal with the Taliban, that Zalmay Khalilzad, a man who's been on our program in the past, seasoned diplomat, is beavering away at, evidently to the exclusion of the Afghan government. Tell us what's going on, Lawrence, and do you anticipate that we're about to see a separate peace struck here?
Well, Frank, I think there's a good possibility that there will be some kind of agreement between the United States and the Taliban. And I'm not sure that's a good one because, as you say, the Afghan government has been completely excluded from the negotiations. In fact, the Taliban refused to negotiate with them because they consider them a puppet government. What is very telling to me in these negotiations is the focus by the Taliban on the withdrawal schedule of the United States and NATO forces from Afghanistan. Now, everything else that they're talking about in terms of an Afghan-Afghan dialogue or ceasefire or women's rights or any of those things are simply not enforceable without the U.S.-NATO presence in Afghanistan. So they may be just giving lip service to these various other things. And once the United States commits to a withdrawal from Afghanistan, the Taliban will be in a position perhaps to enter an interim government, which Pakistan also prefers, and then eventually through military force take over Afghanistan. You will notice, I mean, all the diplomats are talking about there's no military solution in Afghanistan, yet we're seeing before our very eyes that the Taliban and the Pakistani sponsors are pursuing a military solution in Afghanistan.
Yeah, it's not the one we would want, obviously, but it nonetheless is entirely possible. Let me ask you about several things that you just touched on there, Lawrence. In parallel with these talks, which as I understand it, have been kind of in your face in a lot of ways, including, as I say, as I understand it, the representatives from the Gitmo 5, as I think they've been called, senior leaders of the Taliban who were incarcerated in Guantanamo Bay and then exchanged for traitor, basically, by Barack Obama. But quite apart from those negotiations with Zalmay Khalilzad, there's been this other track in which the Taliban have been going through the motions of conversing with Afghans, some of whom I think are in the parliament, women, and so on. Is that all for show? And that it's very cynical that, as you say, when the U.S. is out of the way, that will be the end of that so-called track?
Well, I think it's largely for show, as you point out, especially the negotiations dealing with women's rights. But there's another motive to all this as well. If you recall, the Taliban were engaged in not official negotiations, but meetings with non-government Afghan politicians in Moscow, for example. And this and the recent discussions, as you mentioned, in Doha are an extension of that. Well, in my mind, this goes back to the issue of an interim government. What the Taliban are doing are giving legitimacy to something other than the Afghan government, and then as a foundation to produce this interim government, which both the Taliban and Pakistan prefer, as a segue to forcing the United States and NATO out of Afghanistan and then creating the basis of this interim government as, again, as a segue for eventual Taliban control, which they will pursue regardless because they will, as I said earlier, pursue this military solution as opposed to a political solution because the Taliban come right out and say that they don't believe in elections, and they couldn't win one even if there was an election.
The degree of their contempt for us is on display as well in the fact that they are taking credit for terrorist attacks that are killing significant numbers of people, even as they're engaged in these negotiations with us. So again, it speaks to your point about they're not under any illusion that they can actually achieve their goals through military force, certainly at least once the United States is completely out of the way. Are we looking, as you see it, Lawrence Sellin, at a sort of South Vietnam 1975 kind of spectacle here where American forces are going to be more or less routed from the Afghan territory rather than peace with honor, as Richard Nixon famously promised us?
Well, the short answer is yes. I think we're going to see something very similar to what happened in Vietnam. Of course, they'll frame it as a peace deal and try to put, fig leaves associated with that. And based on these promises that the Taliban are making, for example, that they won't use Afghanistan as a terrorist base as they did before, which to me is nonsense because they have never renounced their association with al-Qaeda. We know that Pakistanis are fighting with the Taliban in Afghanistan. Pakistanis are fighting with the al-Qaeda, who also are fighting with the Taliban in Afghanistan. So I don't think we can believe any of the promises that the Taliban make. And again, because they're entirely focused on a military solution, because they'll never win an election in a democratic Afghanistan.
Yeah. Let me ask you lastly, Lawrence Sellin, about one other facet of this increasingly really disastrous situation, and that is the role of China. It is, as Donald Trump said the other day, now engaged in resource exploitation there. It is clearly aspiring to tie it into the Belt and Road Initiative, Afghanistan, that is. It is helping Pakistan destabilize the place and drive us from it. Give us your quick thoughts on what China's up to and what we should be doing instead of what we're embarked on now with this diplomatic initiative and the prospect of a rout?
Well, this is the big problem as I see it. I think most Americans, if not all Americans, want the United States military out of Afghanistan, which is fine. But the question is, what do you leave behind? And the big winner here is going to be China. If, in fact, the Taliban take over, who are Pakistani proxies, and of course, Pakistan is a all-weather ally to China, you will see essentially what I call a China-Pakistan axis taking control of South Asia. The Chinese will move into Afghanistan economically. The Pakistanis will, through the Taliban, will likely control Afghanistan with militarily. But more than that, the Chinese have plans for military bases along the Balochistan coast, that is the Arabian Sea, which is basically at the mouth of the Strait of Hormuz, and will have control of the vital maritime lanes of the Arabian Sea and the northern Indian Ocean. So that is where the real danger is. What China will benefit from if the United States simply withdraws and doesn't have a plan B in terms of South Asia and the Indian Ocean region.
And very quickly, that plan B should be, as we've discussed before, to try to make this as difficult a sort of takeover for the Chinese as we can, among other places in Balochistan, right?
Yes, I think the United States first should develop a stronger relationship with India to help thwart China. But also, you know, we should not reward Pakistan and China by providing aid to Afghanistan afterwards. And we certainly should exploit two things. First of all, the economic weakness of Pakistan, which would affect China in this case, but also ethnic separatism within Pakistan, which includes both the Pashtuns and the Balochistan independence movement, which I should say recently, the United States just made a really very stupid strategic trade-off with China in terms of calling the Balochistan independence movement terrorist in exchange for naming one of Pakistan's terrorists, Masood Azhar, an international terrorist. It was a very bad deal.
A little peculiar, too. This is the kind of quid pro quo that we've been, I thought, no longer indulging in with Pakistan. Haven't we sort of severed relations with them, more or less?
No, I think in this case, it was a very uninformed quid pro quo, as you point out. And that's essentially what it was. It was a concession to China saying that if China would declare Pakistani terrorist Azhar actually an international terrorist, that we would also in turn designate the Balochistan independence movement as a terrorist organization.
This will be a subject for further conversation. We'll look forward to having you back soon. Lawrence Sellin, come back to us again very soon.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we're joined by Rick Fisher. He is a senior fellow in Asian Military Affairs at the International Assessment and Strategy Center. He has written extensively on the subject of the Chinese military, the buildup it's engaged in, and the threat that it poses to us, and what we must do about it. It's always a delight to catch up with him. Rick Fisher, thank you very much for joining us. Welcome back.
Thank you, Frank.
Top of mind, Rick, is the actual testing of anti-ship ballistic missiles in the South China Sea, evidently launched from some of the man-made islands that the Chinese have conjured up out there, and demonstrating a very ominous capability for our naval combatant forces in the region. Walk us through what's going on and what it implies.
Okay, Frank. The People's Liberation Army held exercises in the South China Sea in two locations, north and south of the Paracel Islands, starting on Saturday, June 29, and ending on about July 3rd. All that we really know for sure is that they tested anti-ship ballistic missiles. What we don't know for sure is which ones were tested, where they were fired from, and what other forces were used in coordination. Back in January, the People's Liberation Army held a joint exercise in the South China Sea that was publicly commented upon and featured the People's Liberation Army Navy and the PLA Rocket Force. The Rocket Force possesses all of the anti-ship ballistic missiles that we know of currently. The exercise of the last week was probably a follow-on from the January exercise. The January exercise probably just featured simulated missile launches, but the last one featured actual missile launches, and it could have included the 1,700-kilometer range Dongfeng DF-21 Delta, or it could have involved the longer-range DF-26, or if indeed these were fired from the new Spratly Island bases, as has been suggested in some of the reporting, it may have featured new shorter-range anti-ship ballistic missiles like the China Aerospace Science and Industry Corporation's CM-401.
A lot of data there, Rick. Let me try to just parse it a little bit. The last time I was briefed on these matters inside the government is a long time ago, but we used to have very high confidence in terms of satellite warning systems about the location of ballistic missiles' launch points. Is that no longer the case, Rick, or are you saying that the U.S. government simply hasn't revealed what it knows about from which of these launch points this particular missile testing was conducted?
Well, Frank, as you know, governments, especially our government, wants to protect its intelligence sources and methods as much as possible. And indeed, we do have assets that from space are very sensitive and would be able to pinpoint immediately the launch locations of any hot exhaust ballistic missile. And the ones that were used in the exercise certainly would have been spotted by our satellites. But no, the government has simply decided not to reveal the nitty-gritty beyond simply saying that anti-ship ballistic missiles were tested. It, in and of itself, a very dangerous development in as much as this is likely China's first ever demonstration of this capability over open ocean.
Mm. I want to come back to that in a moment, Rick, but just staying with the premise that this was from the Spratlys or one of the islands that they've developed out there, would that have violated, in your estimation, commitments that Xi has made about not militarizing these islands? As you've done so much to document, of course, that's been going on now for some time, but this would be a particularly aggressive, in-your-face example of that breach of contract, in a manner of speaking.
Yes. And I mean, every day, from the moment Xi spoke those words, he was in violation of them. And I mean, this is in essence, an exercise in training Americans to be second place, to be subservient, to simply acknowledge that China is more powerful than we are. Yeah, every day there are airplanes, combat ships, missiles, ammunition being transported to these islands. They're fully militarized already.
And they are, as a result, rather formidable power projection instruments in furtherance of what the Chinese have announced as their intention, is it not, to control as essentially sovereign waters what takes place in the South China Sea. And, you know, anybody who wishes to transit it on the water, in the air over it, certainly at least, must seek their permission to do so. Have I got that right?
Right. I mean, the Chinese are already well on their way to networking the South China Sea from low Earth orbit to the bottom of the South China Sea. That will contain the underwater Great Wall of sensors linked to supercomputers. Then you have all the ships Then you have all the weapons on the islands. Then you have aircraft, unmanned aircraft, hypersonic near-Earth or near-space vehicles, and then all the assets in low-Earth orbit. They want to sew up the South China Sea to protect their ballistic missile submarines, but also, yes, to basically put their hand around this major artery of global economic health and commerce, and to be able to control that lifeblood of the world. This is a raw power move. They're not talking about it. They're giving no hint of transparency or compromise. This is, in essence, a military contest, and the United States has really not yet begun to fight back.
Yeah, or even really compete effectively, I would guess, Rick. Do you credit claims that the two things about the deep sea, one, that the Chinese may seek to place weapons there, which could be used to further assert their dominance of this area, and second, that among other things, those sensors and supercomputers and so on may make the oceans of the area considerably more transparent for anti-submarine warfare purposes?
The underwater Great Wall is not just going to exist in the South China Sea. It's going to exist along the whole periphery of China. It's going to light up the oceans from the Bohai Sea down to the Spratlys, and it's going to be deployed. It could very well first be deployed to the waters off Pakistan to help hem in India. And indeed, yes, weapons will be part of the underwater Great Wall, from mines to rising captor torpedo-like mines to unmanned underwater vehicles that can perform surveillance or combat missions.
Now, again, Rick Fisher, when people hear this litany of weaponry and capabilities from this deep seas to the near-Earth space, I'm sure some may think you're, you know, sort of indulging in some fantastical projection. But what I've been impressed by about your work over many years now, Rick, is you actually do your homework with exacting care and can document from, in some cases, firsthand observation of trade shows to what's in the literature that's been published and what's been actually demonstrated now, including this anti-ship ballistic missile. For a long time, people were saying, well, they haven't tested it. We don't know that it'll actually work. But apparently, that's no longer tenable. But just comment on that point, Rick, that none of this is a hallucination. This is what you've been able to document, no?
Well, Frank, indeed. Thank you very much for the compliment. My footnotes speak to me. And I wrap them up and deliver them in hundreds of reports for defense magazines, organizations that I work for, journals and such. It's been a pursuit for 25 years, and it's rewarding, but also very sobering and scary. We are engaged in a vital arms race with China. If we win the arms race, we can keep our children and our grandchildren from marching off to war. If we lose this arms race, then we will all be in great danger.
Rick Fisher, we have to let you go. Thank you so much for your time today and for the superb work you do. Come back to us again very soon. Hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.